The sun is setting on another day in Kruger National Park. It's time to kick back with a gin and tonic and some kudu jerky. I'm Sarah Rovang.
And I'm John Golden. You're listening to Sundowners, conversations about architecture, place, and global travel. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, John. Welcome to our third installment of Sundowners. It's been a big week.
I know. I can't believe that we left Johannesburg on Tuesday. We've seen so much since then.
And we've also had some time to reflect on our time in Joburg.
At least when we weren't busy watching a playful group of lion cubs, or nearly getting our car rammed by an elephant.
So as always, there's been a lot to process. In this episode, we're going to wrap up some thoughts on Johannesburg and recap our past few days on safari.
Yeah, so let's dive in. One of the things that we heard over and over again about Johannesburg, almost from everyone we talked to, Uber drivers, academics, tour guides, is that Joburg is a city of extremes.
Sure, and there's obviously some truth to that. There's a lot of severe poverty, but some pretty astonishing affluence. And despite the end of apartheid, there's still a lot of racial segregation. And then there's the contrast that I've talked about in previous blogs and podcasts between the former mining portions of the city and the suburbs that never saw any mining at all.
But I think one thing we reflected on after leaving was that this idea of the city of extremes maybe doesn't quite capture all of the nuance that we found during our explorations of Joburg.
Yeah, that's right. I think the city of extremes model means placing a lot of focus on binary oppositions rather than seeing all of the shades of gray involved.
Yeah, so I guess, Sarah, you've taught some urban history classes, right? So what are other ways of looking at a city?
Well, one way I've found helpful is to break down your experiences into spatial types. One method I use a lot comes from an urban theorist named Kevin Lynch, who wrote this book called The Idea of the City in 1960. Lynch basically was interested in how people navigate through their urban condition. In other words, how they find their way through a city and get to know the place.
Cool. Can you tell me more about the theory?
So, in talking to a lot of people in several different cities, Lynch found that people relied on roughly the same five categories of spatial types. And they're really intuitive. I bet you could actually guess most of them without me having to tell you. Okay, John, so let's say you're in a new city without a smartphone or a map. How would you use the urban landscape to find your way around?
I guess I would start by looking for any obvious sort of landmarks, any big buildings or any kind of geographical, you know, mountains. And then try to pick out kind of what are the major streets or kind of any sort of areas that seem distinct, and just try to relate that to where I'm at.
Yeah, so you basically captured most of what Lynch found in what you just described. So Lynch basically said that there are these five categories are landmarks, which you pointed out when you were mentioning large buildings or other very easily to identify things in a city. Paths, which can include major streets, but might also include ways of getting around on public transportation, pedestrian paths, basically any way that you can move through a city. And then you mentioned just sort of the contextual feeling of being in one part of the city versus another. And the way that Lynch really wrote about that was as districts and edges. So a district could be any sort of architecturally or culturally distinct place in a city that feels different from another adjacent place. And the things separating those district conditions are usually edges of some kind. The sharp edge that I like to bring up in class when we talk about this theory is that frontage between Central Park and where the buildings of Manhattan start again. Not all edges are that apparent, but that's the general idea. And then the final spatial type kind of combines some of these other types that we've talked about, and that's a node. And that can be an intersection of paths. It can be a landmark that attracts people to gather at. It's basically any kind of charged place in the city that seems to have its own kind of importance.
Okay, so you're saying that every city has these five spatial types, and people use them either consciously or unconsciously to find their way around?
Yeah, so that's absolutely true. But part of what Lynch found was that not every spatial type is equally helpful in every city.
Oh, so this is kind of like how in Venice you can't really follow any particular street because they're so windy and kind of start and stop in random places. You just have to kind of use landmarks and like head in a general direction.
Yeah, precisely. And I think that's really true in Johannesburg as well. So I'm curious, what were the features, sort of architecturally and urbanistically, that stood out to you the most?
I guess there were a lot of landmarks that were really easy to notice. There were these tall buildings like the Carlton Tower or the Ponte City Tower. And there were really some big communication towers that you could see basically anywhere in the city. So I would kind of find myself triangulating my position relative to those towers, and that worked pretty well.
That's absolutely true. And I felt like once we started to get to know the city better, it really started to feel like a city of districts, which in actuality reflects how the city was laid out over time.
Yeah, the different neighborhoods and suburbs had a really distinct feel, and there were some abrupt transitions between them. I would imagine due in large part to the sharp lines drawn during apartheid to keep different races separate.
Yeah, and also depending on which racial group lived in a certain place historically, it had a different architectural character. And we definitely got a feeling for this walking around the central city through neighborhoods like the Fashion District, the Financial District, Braamfontein, Fordsburg, and also seeing the edges of Berea and Hillbrow. Navigating by paths doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense in Joburg, actually, because there are so many different overlapping grids, and really long streets, too, that have such different characters as they pass through multiple districts.
Yeah, that reminds me of Fox Street. We started one of our walking tours at this really trendy microbrew on Fox Street, and then staying on the same street, we walked through a small Chinatown, then we were in the Financial District, and then if you keep going, there would be the Mabuning Precinct, which is a really trendy gentrified area. And then the street keeps going on into the eastern suburbs, which are high crime areas only accessible to locals. And this all occurs at just in a couple of miles.
Yeah, so it felt like on the scale of a few weeks, we were still really using districts and neighborhoods to get around. But even still, inside of a neighborhood, there were these different microclimates that were difficult for an outsider to navigate. We didn't really see that many obvious nodes or gathering places. It felt like maybe just those things that you would have to develop an understanding of in the process of living in Joburg over a number of years. This kind of idea actually, I think, goes back to what we were talking about in the previous episode with the idea of eyes on the street, that sort of psychological feeling of safety that may or may not exist in a given place. I think it takes a lot of lived experience in a place to know which streets feel safe to walk down, for instance. And that feeling, as we discovered in Joburg, can vary from block to block, even if the architectural character is very similar. And a lot of navigating at a high level, I think, is also really cultural. You have to be tuned in to the unspoken rules of that particular place.
Yeah, and that makes me think of the Fashion District. It felt very busy and chaotic, but fundamentally safe. However, there seemed to be those really sort of unwritten rules for getting around and moving through the multi-story improvised malls we saw. Without experienced guides, we would have had no idea how to navigate there.
Yeah, that was really an experience where we were relying on insider knowledge. Our guide, Professor Hannah LaRue, has made a number of friends in various Ethiopian-owned businesses in this area, and that very personal connection allowed us to cross a number of edges that I think visitors might normally not get to.
It seems like a lot of wayfinding is also just paying attention to the intangibles of a place, like those rules.
Absolutely, and I think it can also be the really fine-grained things about a place, right? Like the sort of things that are being sold in a grocery store or pharmacy that can ultimately tell you the most about a place.
Yeah, so I have a question about this whole spatial typologies thing. Can something in a city be more than one type of thing at the same time?
Sure, for instance, there are plenty of nodes that are also landmarks. Think of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Big ol' landmark, but also a huge node which serves as a roundabout for like 10 different streets.
Ah, okay, I see. Yeah, I was thinking along those lines when reflecting back on our tour of Ponte City Tower. It's obviously a landmark because you can see it from most places in Joburg, but it's also this huge housing structure that at one point held over 10,000 people, so that makes me feel like it could also be a district of it in and of itself.
I think you're definitely right. It seems like it's both of those things.
Anyway, so for the listeners, we toured Ponte City Tower on our last day in Joburg. It's this huge cylindrical apartment building, over 50 stories tall, which is really tall for South Africa. And it feels really emblematic of the rise and fall and rise again of Joburg. It started out as an avant-garde high-rise apartment building, luxury apartment for wealthy white immigrants, predominantly Italians in the 1960s. And the area around it was a hip place to be, the Brooklyn of Johannesburg. And over the years, this hip cosmopolitan neighborhood became kind of a haven for mixed-race couples. But historically, the apartheid government found it very hard to police effectively in this area and ensure the separateness of the races that was required by apartheid laws. So, in the mid-1980s, the government decided to take the Ponte City Tower and the surrounding area off of the municipal grid entirely and suspend all services. It was declared a gray area. This precipitated a mass exodus of the wealth and the middle class, and crime skyrocketed in the area. At this point, the Ponte City Tower became kind of a central locus of this neighborhood change, and quite quickly became what is known as a hijacked building, where a drug lord or other criminal figure takes over a building and forces people to pay rent in order to live there. So at one point, there were over 10,000 people living in this building with no electricity or running water, and by all accounts, the conditions were pretty hellish. The center of the cylinder is actually completely open, so residents would just throw their trash down into the hollow center rather than carry it down 50 flights of stairs. Our guide told us that eventually the trash heap grew up to 14 stories tall in the interior of the building. And it was like that as recently as 2004. So, well after the end of apartheid, this area was entirely out of governmental control and run instead by criminals. Our guide grew up in the neighborhood, and as a young kid, his parents used to tell him that if he didn't stay in school and get an education, he would end up living in Ponte City Tower. But fortunes turned once it was announced that South Africa would host the 2010 World Cup. Now, there was a new push to start cleaning up this neighborhood in particular, and our guide remembers seeing the lights turn on in the tower for the first time and really feeling like things were changing for the better. It took many years to get all of the hijackers out of the building and clean and renovate the apartments, but now it's full of predominantly middle-class families, including our guide and his family.
If you want to hear more about Ponte City Tower, there's a great episode about it on the podcast 99% Invisible that goes into a lot more detail about its history.
Yeah, we also just had a really great time on this tour. It's run by a local nonprofit that has their office on the first floor of Ponte.
Yeah, so this tour group, Ndolaje, employs young people from the neighborhood to give tours like the one that we went on. The proceeds raised from the tours go into supporting community activities, such as a new youth space on the ground floor of Ponte that we actually got to see. They also have this former penthouse on the 52nd floor that can be rented out as an event space or used as part of the Ponte City tour. It was such a light-filled, beautifully designed space that I think we both felt really optimistic leaving that tour.
And maybe that's a good place to leave our discussion of Johannesburg, on the 52nd floor of Ponte, looking out over a city that's rapidly changing and, in many ways, hopefully for the good.
So let's transition then from ultra-urban Joburg to our very different experience on safari.
Yeah, so Sarah, this was your first safari.
That's right.
So did you really have any idea what to expect from the experience?
No, I didn't. I knew that there would be an opportunity to go see animals out in a vehicle with a guide, and that the place we were staying looked really nice, but that's kind of about it.
So, how'd you like it?
Well, it was really nice. During our time in Joburg, I had all of these things planned out around my Brooks travel theme, and we had to figure out how to get to all of those places, and then we had to decide exactly what we were going to do once we got there, and what we're going to see and eat. And I realized that's what the rest of the trip is probably going to feel like as well. And it was exhausting. So it was really pleasant to have a few days where someone else was making all of the decisions.
Yeah, it really felt like the pace agreed with us, which is nice. I think we often struggle finding the right balance between activities and relaxing while on vacation, and going on the safari felt like a really nice blend.
So our trip started off by driving from Joburg to the Kruger area, which is about 7 hours to the northeast, right on the border with Mozambique. We've actually gotten quite a few kilometers under our belt already here in South Africa, and we'll talk about what the road experience is like here in a later episode or newsletter.
Yeah, so our first stop was a lodge inside of a private game reserve called Klaseri that's attached to the larger national park called Kruger. And there are no fences between the two parks, so you can see the same animals. And the lodge we stayed at is called Klaseri Sands, and I gotta say, it was nice.
Not cheap at all, but definitely worth the money.
Yeah, I actually found the economics behind the private lodge system in and around Kruger pretty interesting. The way it works is that you stay at what are often pretty small lodges. Ours had a maximum of 8 guests, and though some are a bit bigger. And you go on game drives in a big Land Rover twice a day, one for sunrise and one for sunset. The drives last maybe 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah, staying at this private lodge kind of felt like we were on a cruise ship or something. Everything is taken care of for you, and there are no decisions or money necessary, because the cost of stay includes all of the food and drink, and the schedule is set by the staff.
Yeah, I think they have to do it this way, because the lodges are, by design, really remote, so you can't be expected to go out to dinner or really do anything beyond go on guided drives or walks. And I think there's enough demand for this kind of experience that they are rewarded to push it to the very luxurious end of things. But, you know, when you factor in the cost of the ranger and the tracker taking you and a handful of other people out for up to 8 hours a day, plus the cost of food and drink, then there's really no way this could be a cheap experience at all. And, you know, fundamentally, the product they're selling, the chance to be really up close with these animals in their natural habit, is really unique, and I think we felt quite valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. We were only there for 2 nights, so we went on 4 of these drives. One on the afternoon we arrived, 2 the next day, and then 1 on the morning before we left. And one of the best parts about the drives was just being out in nature, with your only job really being to just sort of mildly look around. You could trust that the guide and the tracker were going to spot anything that might pass, and so you basically just got to sit back and relax and take it all in. As our guide put it, and this really did feel true, just being out in the landscape justifies the drive. The animals are just gravy.
That being said, seeing all the animals was pretty damn cool. So zebra, giraffe, elephants, kudu, and impala form kind of the bread and butter of the animal landscape here. And they were present on pretty much every drive. And just kudu are like big deer, impala are like small deer. Wildebeest and water buffalo were also pretty common. We saw lots of those as well.
An obvious highlight, though, was the large pride of lions we saw on our first morning game drive. It was a great sighting, as the lions were in full view and not obscured by grass or bushes. Plus, they were moving around a fair bit, unlike other times we saw them just kind of lying there.
Yeah, lazy lions.
Another sort of highlight of that lion sighting were the 3 cubs that were part of the pride. And they were very young and also absolutely adorable.
And just after seeing that pride, we came across a young solo male lion chomping on a fresh wildebeest kill. I kind of loved how much his chewing on a bone face reminded me of our dogs chewing on a bone face.
So after getting back to the lodge, we had a nice breakfast, and then we got to relax for about 4 hours. The lodge had a nice little gym for a workout, and the patio was really well done. Plenty of spaces to just relax, read, or nap. And just as we were finishing lunch out on the patio, this solo elephant came over to the watering hole near the lodge, and he put on quite a show.
Yeah, he even came over to try and drink from the pool at our lodge, but apparently the chlorine taste was not to his liking. And after munching on a tree that we had been sitting under not 20 minutes earlier, he sauntered off.
That was so fun. It was amazing being so close to the animals. We found that seeing a rare animal in binoculars wasn't nearly as fun as having a pack of elephants eating lunch all around your car. Speaking of which, here's some audio we recorded of another elephant right outside our room later that night. That whooping sound you can also hear at the beginning, those were some hyenas in the distance.
Another highlight from our time in the private lodge was seeing a rhino, which are unfortunately increasingly endangered due to poaching. On our second morning, our guide was on the radio with some of the other guides in the area, and they were able to track one down. In this private reserve, there is a network of dirt roads that the guide mainly drove on, but obviously the Land Rover could go off-road in pursuit of particularly good game, and this was the case with the rhino. We tracked it deep into the bush, which again made the experience a lot more exciting for us.
Yeah, it was also really interesting to see how the guide and the spotter worked together to identify telltale signs of animal presence in the bush. They would look for tracks, also called spoor, or fresh dung, along with species-specific marks on the landscape, such as the drag marks left by leopards dragging prey through the dirt, or trees stripped of their lower bark by elephants.
Yeah, it was also cool how they used the words for animals in different languages to keep the guests from knowing what they were talking about. They said they do this just to keep expectations low so that it's more exciting when we do see something. Also, our guide was frequently on the radio with other guides in the area, sharing information about tracks and sounds and sightings. That was another nice thing about the Klaseri Reserve. There weren't so many vehicles out that any one sighting got crowded, and this can be a real problem in other areas. But there were enough guides out there that they could collaborate well.
Yeah, it was great having my first sundowner. The staff at the lodge would always take your sundowner request at lunchtime, then pack up all of the drinks and snacks into a cooler so that you could have them out in the bush as the sun went down.
And after the sundowner, we'd make our way back to the lodge. And at this point, it was pretty dark, so the spotter would get out a flashlight and try to spot nocturnal game that might be lurking in the bush.
Dinners were great too. On our first night, they put together the dinner table out in a dry riverbed near the lodge and did this big grilling feast called a braai here in South Africa.
Yeah, and the staff had to keep an eye out for any animals approaching, and I definitely saw them shine the flashlight on at least one interested party. I think it was only a hyena, though.
So after dinner, we'd head straight to bed, as wake-up time was 5:45 a.m. for the sunrise drive on the next day. And as apparently is custom in South Africa, there was a bottle of sherry in our room for a little nightcap. I definitely found that, even though safari isn't that physically taxing, game drives still felt really exhausting.
Yeah, definitely. But I gotta say, in the future, I'd love to come back for a longer time at one of these private lodges. The pace of life, early morning drive, lazy afternoon, then sunset drive, and a nice dinner was really pleasant.
For sure.
So after our time at the private lodge, we continued our safari by going into the main Kruger Camp, which is a huge national park. And there you can do what are called self-drive safaris, which is exactly what it sounds like. You get to drive around the park in your own car. But you have to stay on the designated roads, some of which are paved, some of which are dirt. And then you sleep at these large rustic rest camps throughout the park. And these have basic bungalows or tented campsites, but they're still pretty expensive. I think it was like $100 a night.
So the self-drive portion of our trip was also great, although obviously it had fewer amenities than the private lodge. But the main benefit of driving around Kruger yourself is that it seemed like there were a lot more animals than in the Klaseri Reserve. So it was easier to find yourself in the middle of like 15 elephants, even if you couldn't drive off the road.
Yeah, and the downsides of the self-driver, mainly that obviously you can't track the stuff down, and you have to be constantly on the lookout. So my neck was sore after each of our own drives. And in the busier parts of Kruger, you could see like 20 cars all parked around a single lion. So crowding is really an issue. But we avoided the crowds and still saw some great stuff, including a leopard crossing the road in the middle of stalking a herd of kudus.
We actually saw it chase after a young kudu, but we couldn't see the result of that chase because they ran off into the bush.
Yeah, and I think seeing a leopard is relatively rare, so we felt really lucky to have been in the right place at the right time for that.
We also, as previously mentioned, had a lot of great elephant encounters. In particular, there was this group of elephants that completely surrounded our car while eating. There was even a baby elephant, can't have been more than a year old, just adorable.
Yeah, and then after that herd moved on, we drove past a young male elephant who seemed kind of upset about our presence, but I guess he was too far away to do anything about it. Unfortunately, we realized that the road we were on was a dead end, and so we had to turn around and go past this guy again. As we drove past, he wasted no time in tromping over right in front of us and giving us a real hard look. Fortunately, we had heard from our guide at Klaseri that you shouldn't back away from these aggressive young males, as that only entices them further. So we stayed put, and eventually he walked off after a few huffs and puffs. So after he was, 50 feet away or so, and he had his back to us, we started slowly moving forward again. But at that point, he immediately turned around and started charging at us. Fortunately, we were enough ahead of him that we could floor the gas and get away. But boy, did that get our hearts pumping.
Yeah, this is definitely the most exciting moment of the safari.
Anyway, I'll keep posting pictures to Instagram. We had a lot of other great animal sightings, and I think we felt really fortunate with all the stuff we got to see.
And also, while we were mostly successful in relaxing and not overanalyzing everything, I think we were both a bit bummed by the absence of interpretation pertaining to ecological impact, either in Kruger or at Klaseri.
Yeah, and it felt a bit odd since going on safari is advertised as ecotourism.
Yeah, the construction of dirt roads for safari vehicles and the act of building a safari lodge out in the middle of the bush, not to mention bringing in all of the outside food, water, and supplies necessary to run it, are not environmentally neutral acts. It really seems like it's a trade-off. The money that comes in from the parks helps sponsor conservation efforts, but undoubtedly places an ecological strain on these environmental systems as well.
Yeah, and there was this just mysterious $50 a night conservation fee that we had to pay in Kruger, which they just spring on you at check-in. You know, we're happy to support conservation, but this was never explained on any website or by the receptionist, and so we didn't really understand where this was going.
Yeah, and actually one of the only places in either Kruger or Klaseri where we saw conservation referenced was this fantastic elephant museum at the rest camp where we stayed in Kruger. I'd actually put this museum up there with the Workers' Museum in Joburg as hidden museum gems so far on our trip.
Yeah, this was a really smart little museum, and based on the number of kids in school uniforms we saw during the day, I think it gets a lot of good use.
Yeah, they did a really good job of addressing the various issues around the elephant population management. Kruger actually didn't historically have that many elephants, and now the population is so high that it's having some detrimental effects on the environment. So elephants, for example, strip the bark off of trees, which makes those trees more susceptible to forest fires. And that's fine until there are so many elephants that most trees have lost their bark. And historically, elephants, when they got out of control population-wise, were culled by the rangers, which actually created lasting trauma for the herds. You've probably heard the saying, an elephant never forgets. Turns out that's true. So today, in order to avoid that trauma, elephant populations are managed by closing watering holes, which mimics more natural means of population control.
And all that was really great to read about in the museum. But it would have been wonderful to have even more focus on environmental education throughout the safari experience.
So also my most recent blog post deals with the structure and experience of ecotourism that we've experienced so far, so be sure to check that out for more.
Well, I think that about wraps it up for this week. Thanks as always for listening, and please let us know what you think. If you're listening to this, you probably already have our email addresses, so drop us a line and let us know what you like or don't like. As always, our theme music is by Mark Barrett, and don't forget to subscribe.
Happy trails, listeners. Catch you next week.